Welcome, everyone. And I'm sure you're all attending this talk this afternoon expecting me to tell you how to make a fortune. To be honest, I don't have a clue how to make a fortune. They're more or less, they try to work around the titles that I find listed. And of course, it all really amounts to, you know, what we're all really interested in is how to live our lives so that we develop wisdom, understanding of our human state, and while we're still, you know, compos mentis, still able to function and reflect and consider. This is the great benefit of being a human being. So in Buddhist terms, they always say, the Buddhists always say, the human birth is the most fortunate one. And then they list all these different heavenly realms from the... I heard somebody was telling me today that the highest heavenly realm, the Apasura splendid realm, then it's so perfect, it's absolutely perfect, but it's still unsatisfactory because it's perfect. Every Apasura Deva looks exactly like each other, you know. Completely fair. Everybody is all the same, all beautiful, all radiant. So just try to imagine that one. And then all the different realms, there's many in cosmology, Buddhist cosmology, the different, you know, levels of Devadas and Brahma gods, and then into the human realm, and or the Asura realm, which are like titanic creatures. They're power-hungry deities. And there's a lot of those these days in the world. Power-hungry, especially in countries like this. And so then, I imagine in any country you can go to, there's this desire for power, because power certainly is a thrilling kind of energy. It really, you know, it's very difficult to handle power wisely, because it does blind you, like sexual desire is so overwhelming, you lose, you know, if you're not very mindful, you lose all perspective. And then, well, with power, you know, political power, economic power, social power, also, this, imagine, is very overwhelming. That's why so many tragedies and about hubris, you know, where those people who have power are completely blinded by it and end up destroying themselves. So we see that, you know, like Saddam Hussein and Stalin and Hitler and people like that are, you know, so overwhelmed that they think they're invincible. So a reflective ability, like on the human level, even though we would say like Saddam and Stalin and Hitler are all human beings, their mentality tended to dwell in this power realm of what they call the Asura realm, where you lose perspective. So being born into this realm is not considered a particularly fortunate rebirth, even though it's probably a very exciting one, but it usually it's a disaster. So then there's the human realm, and below that the animal, the hungry ghost, and the different levels of hell. Well, these are just ways of putting into perspective the different conditions that we as human beings experience, because we have all these potential rebirths within the human lifetime of our own lifetime. So many of you have, you know, have experienced very refined aesthetic beauty, truths, and the more kind of refined states of consciousness, the power, and then the human being is a moral realm. So the attitude is that human beings decide, even though we have these power hungry abilities, we can become demonic, we can become, you know, we can become very deceitful, greedy, inconsiderate, sensitive, and quite capable of killing each other. So the moral realm is one where we decide how to behave. You know, agreements on how we're going to live with each other. And so this is a great gift, actually, when you think of it. If we didn't have this ability, I mean, even though this is not mentioned very much these days, morality is usually used as a kind of, for power these days, to kind of gain votes. You talk about morality always in the level of being rewarded for good behavior and being punished for bad. But in Buddhist terms, morality is an agreement. We awaken to the wisdom of this, to the need to decide if we're going to live in the same town, the same house, the same community. We have to agree on how, you know, we're going to live so that we're not brutalizing, deceiving, exploiting, stealing from each other, sexually abusing each other, or getting caught in all kinds of habits such as drink and drugs, which make us heedless, where the moral precepts seem to fall away. So the five precepts is a kind of entry in Buddhist terms into the realm of the manusia, or the human being. Now this is interesting because, you know, we have the killer instincts. We have the hate and greed and jealousy and fear, all the same primal urges and emotions of the animal realm. We can become demonic, as we've seen in the news of people who just love to torture and persecute and brutalize others. Say, well, that's a demonic, that's not a human trait. That's what I'd call a demonic energy that we could all be taken over by if we didn't have some kind of sense of agreement on how we're going to behave. So, just like the first precept, Bhānādibhāta, refrain from intentionally killing another human being. And so these precepts, the five precepts, recognize that they're agreements and they're guidelines. They're not commandments, not imperatives, but we don't have to take them, or we have to ask for them. I can't just say, force you to take the five precepts. It's against the discipline of a Buddhist monk to say, you've got to take the five precepts if you're going to come to Amaravati. You have to see, you know, to ask me to take them. So this puts it into perspective. This is a decision you've made on how you're going to relate to other human beings. Now, some people get very, I just gave a retreat recently here, where, you know, people get into with, you know, the first precept in killing an ant or something like that, is that breaking the precept? And so, you know, we can refine it. Now, this is up to you yourself, how far you want to go with this precept. So I always put it on its most basic agreement, not to kill other human beings. I mean, that's important to see. That's the importance of it. And then we can, like for Buddhist samanas, we refine that. So we can't intentionally kill anything. But that's a monastic precept, and that's something, or that's in in the eight precepts, as we develop more mindfulness, then we can determine it on a finer scale. But you see what I'm pointing at is, it's up to you really how to use these precepts to develop, to cultivate, to get to know yourself and know the energies and the fears and the desires that human individuals have. And we all have our own. None of us are born in the Apasura Devaloka, where we all are the same anyway, so we wouldn't have to agree on such issues. But we have, you know, we all look different, have different tendencies, characteristics, ways of looking at something, cultural biases, personal attitudes, karma from the past, ancestral tendencies, and who knows what, you know, so we're more aware of how different we are, you know, how individual and different. And when you're living in a community like Amaravati, when you first live a communal life and monastic life, you know, one tends to start from an idealistic position of how everybody should be. And so you kind of want everybody to behave themselves, keep the precepts, be on time for the pujas, and everybody pulling together, rowing in the same direction. Good team spirit, you know. Nobody's going against the current. Everybody and the whole thing's in harmony. That's an ideal. That's how I'd like it to be. But I've never seen that happen yet. There are moments where that does happen, you know. You can't keep it that way. I remember when I was in Sri Lanka years ago, they invited me to one of their military academy, and they wanted me to. They were graduating; cadets were graduating in this academy, so I went to it . And it was very, very impressive because everybody, they're so well drilled, all these soldiers, marching in step, every movement synchronized, everything just perfect. You know, their uniforms starched completely, clean, immaculate, drilled, everybody moving in one way all at the same time. And I thought, you know, that's how I would kind of like Amaravati to be. Because it's so impressive to look at. It was really impressive to the eye. But then, if you've ever been in the military, you know that you can't live like that. You can perform like that maybe through practice in a parade ground, but you can't live like that. And so we do have to have agreements on how we're going to live, and basically we have this sila, or translated as morality. And so these are also ways of living in the world, even if you have no spiritual longing or interest in religion or anything like that. You know, you don't care about transcending dukkha or being saved from suffering or delusion. All you want to do is have a happy life. Have a good family life, get along with people, and find some peace and contentment within the human situation. Well, then the five precepts definitely are supportive of that. And also, you know, creates good conditions so you might be able to make a fortune. But I don't guarantee it. Because then I'm going to keep the five precepts so I can become a it's no longer millionaire, it's nothing. Multi-millionaire. But that's not the reason we keep, you know, that's kind of cheating on the precepts. But seeing, you know, weighing the, you know, how to live with another person, with one other person, or with your family, or with the staff in the factory, or the office, or in the village. In the society in general. Well, these are excellent guidelines for for agreements for behavior, because it does create a lot of trust, mutual trust. So, for example, here at Amravati, because we have these precepts, even though we have, you know, disagreements, problems, and suspicions, and that on a personal level, basically around behavior, we have an enormous amount of trust. And it doesn't matter, make you, you know, like you love everybody equally and like everybody, and the community is always harmonious. But there is a level of trust on that, on the moral ground, that we can take for granted even, because of the intention that everybody has when they join this community. Now, in the aim of Buddha Dhamma, you know, the ultimate aim is for liberation from the world, not to make a fortune in it or just be happy. And next month I'm going attending the first European Conference on Happiness in London. I'm a speaker. They asked me to be one of the speakers it's called the first European Conference on Happiness. And they convinced me to participate. Fair enough. So, happiness is something, you know, that when you're asked to be a keynote speaker on happiness, it does, you know, it does give you a chance to reflect on the use of this word. You know, what do we mean by happiness? We use it. I want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. We spend a lot of money trying to be happy. We keep looking for it and feel disappointed when we don't get happy, don't get enough happiness. And in the country of Bhutan, you know, that little Asian mountain kingdom north of India, they have the gross national product is happiness, and that's impressed everybody, because that's what you hear all the time. They say, Bhutan is not about, you know, gross national product being something but other than happiness. Well, that's quite an interesting way of looking, of running the country. Because we would never think of that, a gross national product, as happiness, would we? I wouldn't. I got the idea from Bhutan. So I've reflected a lot, because happiness, we do have a lot of happiness as human beings. You know, even though the First Noble Truth is about unsatisfactoriness, the dukkha, the sense of whatever, you know, life in general is the experience of, we're never truly satisfied with anything. Everything we grasp and try to hold on to and keep and attain will inevitably disappoint us. So there's this unsatisfactoriness, this sense of even when you make a fortune, there's still the unsatisfactoriness, the fear of losing it. You know, it goes together. If you win a prize, or you win a football match or something, there's this great feeling of joy and happiness, elation when you win. But then there's also, goes along with that, will we win the next one? They go together every time, you know. So you win, you know, even if you win the lottery, there's still the possibility of losing it. It's just Northern Bank, you know, Northern Rock, there's panic because people might lose the thing that they depend on to feel secure. But happiness is also part of being human, and there's a lot to be happy about in the human realm. But when we see that happiness is very conditioned, depends on, in many ways, what we generally consider happiness is very dependent on conditions supporting that particular feeling. And the conditioned realm is nature to change. So you can't keep a happy condition as a permanent refuge, because the conditions that support happiness are changing. And so it inevitably, you're going to lose it if you're dependent on attaining or achieving happiness through getting what you want, through being a winner, through having a fortune, through finding the right person, through owning your own house, having a new car, through just keeping the moral precepts. And also then there's the kind of happiness we have of giving. Less selfish happiness, more unselfish kind of joyfulness that we get out of sharing what we have, of giving to others. So that, in terms of Buddhist words, is like dana. This is the kind of basis of Buddhist development, is dana, or generosity. So this also brings joyfulness into one's life. But and joyfulness isn't because you're getting something, you're getting what you want, you're giving something. And that's a different kind of happiness than getting what you've wanted. So like today is Sunday in the morning, of course the Sunday is a time where a lot of people come to offer dana, sangha dana to the monastic community here. And it's always a very joyful day. Because, you know, so many people come to just bring, they usually bring the best food they can possibly get and offer it to us. And they seem to get a lot of joy out of this. It's a different feeling than if it was quid pro quo. You know, I give you food, you give me something back. that's not the attitude of dana, but it's like you know, I'm just giving this, sharing what I have and what you need. So this is another what we call a factor to develop in life. Because there's still a very selfish attitude. If I get what I want, I'll be happy. Is very, you know, still very, you know, it's very human, but it's very mature. You know, you feel, you know, you're a child, you think your mother should give you everything you want and you'll be happy. And when she does, you are happy for a moment, but then you start wanting something else. So it doesn't take too much to see that just getting what you want. Some people have this shopping addiction, don't they? There's really, you know, they become addicted to getting what they want and going to London. They keep buying things, so they have, you know, spend a lot of money to get all kinds of things that they want. But it becomes a more like an addiction, an obsession of the mind, which leads to create other endless problems for one's life. Where the joy of giving we're encouraged not to do it for selfish reasons. Not to do it to get something, get some kind of pleasant state of mind or get something in return, but just for the joy of giving. In itself, it's its own reward. You don't need to be rewarded for it. So in Thailand, you know, this was very difficult for me when I first became a monk in Thailand, because you go on the alms round, you know, and you go out in the town, with your alms bowl, and then people put food into your alms bowl. Well, being American, you know, somebody puts something in, gives you something, you say thank you. So, you know, I was the first to Samanera, so I remember going out and somebody put something in my alms bowl and said thank you. And then the monk said, no, you can't do that. Well, why not? He said, because, you know, she's getting something back. You want to give her full merit. I never thought of it like that. Americans would never think of that. You know, always saying thank you. I even found, I was so addicted to saying thank you that somebody stepped on my toe once. I said thank you. So then in Thailand, you had to train myself, you know, because the impulse, the cultural impulse, this is about culture, different attitudes around culture. You know, and then they, you know, some people give you really the kind of food you want, and you feel like, oh, thanks, thank you, thank you, thank you. Instead, you have to walk on. But it was a good reflection on one's own cultural conditioning, because in the States, you know, we say thank you for everything, even stepping on your toe. That's a bit over the top, but it shows how habitual, you know, that word can become. Or sorry, here in England, everybody say, "I'm sorry, sorry, sorry for everything. Sorry, I'm here." Sorry for breathing. Sorry for crossing your field of vision. So these are cultural, you know, addictions that we have. So then, you know, these are, you know, not saying thank you, and that can be just being rude, you know, because monks can be arrogant. You know, we can get very arrogant. We can, you know, you give me some food, and I don't particularly like that. Well, I'm giving you very good food today. You never say that out loud, or you might think it. but still, you know, this is, you kind of think that you're doing people a favor by letting them give you things. And so it's both the one who offers and the one that receives to develop this awareness of how the mind, how your ego, how your personality operates. And also your cultural conditioning, because these affect every moment, you know, how we react to experience. So in this way, you know, being able to adapt to, say, my adapting to Thai culture, because it was very different from what I, you know, what I would do in the States. But basically, it's based on the same kind of moral values. The five precepts where, you know, you could easily use them in any Christian church. You know, they're Jewish, you know, they're not particularly Buddhist, and no other religion has ever thought of them. They're just, you know, really quite common sense agreements on behavior. Now then we agree to that, but then we can feel desire to murder, to steal, to break these precepts. So it's not a matter of taking, the point is in bhavana or meditation, we're observing these conditions that come up in our consciousness. So if we feel like killing somebody, you know, we acknowledge that that is a condition that is in the consciousness now. But, you know, because of the first precept, I don't act on it. So, and this is what we call reflection. You have, if we were just killers, you know, basically programmed to kill, like cats are killers. As all you love cats, now don't be offended, but they're supposed to kill. You know, this is their nature. So you know, you can't get them to take even the first precept, because you can frighten them. You know, by hitting them or something when they, you know. But often, you know, how many of you have had cats that bring home their prey to show you? You know, we used to have one that used to bring home, you know, dead mice and birds into the house. And so, you know, he's offering us a gift. It's kind of a Donna. So even, you know, they have this, the desire to be generous and to not just eat everything for themselves. But of course, you know, we didn't particularly appreciate it. We tried to say, no, don't do that. Don't kill anything. It doesn't mean anything because their karma is different. It's an animal's karma. They're supposed to kill. They're not immoral for doing it. You can't apply morality to animals and say they're immoral because a cat will kill a bird. It's their nature to do so. And so this, but we, human beings, we might have the same impulse, but we can reflect on that by saying the first precept, banadi ban, not to intentionally kill anybody, or if we want to refine that to animals or insects, then it helps us to see, because we do have that impulse to kill what's in the way, or to kill a thing that, you know, if you've been brought up in a family where they like to fish or hunt, you know, this is part of one's cultural conditioning. To see birds fly up in the air, something you shoot, or see fish in the water, something you catch. And then it's just part of the way one looks at life. Say when you're young, you get your parents kind of, and your culture condition you to see it in this way. But we also have this ability to reflect. And this is the great gift of being human in Buddhist terms. We have a reflective mind. Or to put it in another way, a Buddha mind. We talk in Mahayana Buddhism, they talk about Buddha nature. And so this is, they have different Buddha, you know, something that we don't quite know what that is, Buddha nature. Or, you know, because it is a word, maybe, and we feel it is something maybe we don't have. Or that it's something we've got to find. But our being human is we have a Buddha nature already. It's a human birth. And then whether we awaken to that or not is something else. Whether we actually, I mean, it doesn't have to be called Buddha nature either. This is just a particular religious convention's way of talking. We're not saying Christians don't have Buddha nature. Because they do, but they wouldn't call it Buddha nature. They probably call it Christ consciousness or something like that. But I mean, the words aren't important. What it is this natural ability that we have as human individuals to be aware of what's happening inside us. We can contemplate the result of killing something or stealing. How many of you have told lies or stolen something and then felt guilty or ashamed of it? You know, and you feel the sense that it was wrong to have done so. Now that can come from just guilt, and we can become obsessed with guilt, feel guilty about, you know, everything because we're not perfect. Or we do have a sense of if I tell a lie, I do know it. I know, even if I don't want to know it, I still, a part of me knows I'm not telling the truth. And so this is what we want to get to, is to be observe this, because sometimes in some situations it's more convenient or more even appropriate to tell a lie. But we can feel guilty about it. And that's because we've already grasped the idea that telling a lie is bad or evil. But telling a lie also is, we agree not to do this. And it's a guideline. It's not a kind of moral imperative. So then you get these questions like, what if, you know, I remember reading a true story about, it happened during World War II in Holland, and some Dutch family was harboring some Jews, Jewish children, in their house. And of course, the Nazis wanted to, were arresting all the Jews, sending them off to Auschwitz. So when they came to the house, they said, "Do you have any Jews here?" And the woman said, "Well, I can't tell a lie, yes." So they took the Jews and sent them off to Auschwitz. Well, I mean, that was, to me, that wasn't very appropriate, you know, considering time and place. I mean, it is a kind of fidelity to a rule, you know, but is it appropriate? And this is where we reflect, you know, to time and place. What is the situation we're in right now? Not some ideal situation or some ordinary, but we're all forced, have to face contingencies in our life or special situations that we have to deal with through spontaneity, through compassion, through understanding the conditions that have arisen in this one moment. And that, of course, is the developing of satipanya, or mindfulness and wisdom. So that we can adapt our behavior to what we know is appropriate to the particular situation. And you see what I mean? But if we say, well, morality, you can just break it any time, you know, when you feel like telling, I just tell one, don't do it. That's not it. That's not what I'm saying. But seeing how to use these precepts to as agreements, as something to treasure and value, but then also to be able to take into account particular situations. And this you have to learn how to trust yourself, your intuitive sense, not just your feelings of the moment, not just emotional reactions, but much deeper than that, a sense of compassion arises. That's not an emotion that you cultivate. Compassion comes out of the pure awareness. Compassion isn't a personal quality that one can own to, but it's a natural state that comes through when we let go of ignorance and greed, hatred, and delusion, and then our relationship to the misfortunes of the world, of other people, towards the animals or whoever, is one of karuna, or compassion. And that compassion, of course, is a very pure state. It's not patronizing, like me feeling sorry for you because you're so unfortunate. It's a real sense of compassion, meaning we understand the suffering, the unhappiness, the difficulties of human existence on this planet. We can all relate to the unhappiness, the suffering of other creatures because of our own. We've already, understand our own dissatisfaction or unhappiness or anxiety and fears. So it's, somebody gave me this yesterday, timer, vibrating timer. And so I've set it for 3 o'clock, just to see if it works. It can do all kinds of, this little thing can do all kinds of things, I hope. Now the reason why so many people in the Western world now have taken an interest in Buddhism, especially in Buddhist meditation, and this word meditation, this is what most of us are really interested in, what attracts us to this particular teaching. And this is ability to reflect on life, to observe, to notice, to awaken to the way it is. Now the thinking mind, when we think about life, you know, when we get caught in our thinking, our cultural conditioning, our values, our personality, our ego, that sense of me being separate personality, that identity, my individuality, my personality, myself, that sense of me being a separate person, and cultural conditioning, and the thinking process itself. This is a critical function of mind. Because the thinking process is what we call dualistic. You have good, then you have bad. You have right and wrong, heaven and hell, male and female. You have day and night. You've got, this is discrimination, isn't it? According to the condition. You discriminate, and this is bigger than that. This clock down here is much bigger than this one. Now that's a discrimination. And then I say, is it that because it's bigger, it's a better clock? Not necessarily, is it? It's easier to look at, I'll tell you, when you've got vision like mine. But that doesn't vibrate. You have to keep looking at it. We'll see if this one does or not. But then we can say bigger is better, can't we? There's a lot of kind of spurious logic in it, you know. If it's bigger, it must be better. Or smaller, small is beautiful, black is beautiful. We can say anything. You know, on that level, we can say everything is the same, like the Apasara Devaloka. Everybody is exactly the same. But that's not the way it really is. That's how it is ultimately. But on the level of discrimination, conditioning, everything, nothing's the same. We might hold it all. We might think it should be the same, but it's not. And as a child, I remember, feeling quite distressed because being brought up as a Christian, you know, I was told God loved everyone equally. And yet some people seem to have so many better qualities, richer, better looking, more intelligent, better opportunities, good fortune, and others didn't. Why would God allow somebody to be born disabled if he loved us equally? Why didn't he just create, stop with the Apasara Devaloka? And where we are all exactly the same, you know, because that's the kind of logic of a child, isn't it? If God loves us equally, why did he create some people very beautiful and others very ugly, or some very healthy and some sickly? And of course they can't answer that, you know, because you only have one life in that system, you know, so you get born and then if you're born with defects and poverty and bad parents and born in a battlefield or whatever, you know. And there are, you know, at this time in the world, you read about it, you know, all the war orphans in Africa and in Middle East and all the miserable things that are going on in the world where the present age that are so quite morally and in every way quite repulsive to see. And you feel a real sadness at what's happening, the disrespect for life and the exploitation of the planet and the desire for power and using it just for yourself and your own group at the expense of everyone else. Well, there's something in me on the level of discrimination that is repelled by that. You know, that's not right. It shouldn't be like that. But then, now that this is my thinking process, I'm thinking this, and it is right. But right also has its opposite, wrong. And so right and wrong go together. You know, like birth and death, like an inhalation and exhalation. You can't have one without the other. So when you do win something, then you're inevitably going to lose what you win. You know, even at death is a kind of where you lose everything at the end. You can't take it with you, in other words. So that this reflection on the way it is not discriminatory. It's not judging. It's not saying it's right or wrong. It's just observing. It's intuitive, what I call intuitive awareness, where you're it's fully conscious, it's intelligent, but it's not discriminating, but it is discerning. And discernment is not discriminating, not saying one thing's better or worse, but it's like this. So when we talk about all conditions being impermanent, this is one of the main vipassana meditations, isn't it, to contemplate impermanency of conditions. We can assume from the critical mind that because conditions are impermanent and unsatisfactory, that somehow they're inferior. With the way we even bring this discrimination into our way of relating to meditation. So that's why trying to encourage people to develop or cultivate or begin to recognize this natural state of intuitive awareness, which is non-discriminatory. But it's intelligent, it's discerning, and it sees conditioned phenomena. It observes the changingness of conditioned phenomena. And so this is what we call reflecting on the way it is. You observe, like if you have a desire to kill somebody, you can observe that. Then you judge it. Say, oh, I'm a terrible person because I'm a killer at heart. I want to kill Ajahn Sumedho. But I'm not doing it because I took the precept. But then you can feel guilty about it and say, if I were a good person, I'd never have such a terrible desire. Or if you're using discernment, you're recognizing that at this moment, this condition has arisen. It's like this. So we say whether it's, you know, wanting to kill Ajahn Sumedho or not, it is a changing condition. And of course, we don't act on those kind of impulses, but we certainly can have them. I mean, how many of you with children and families and partners and so forth have wanted to murder them? And then feel guilty about it. You know, feel that you're a bad person because a good mother would never want to harm her children or anything like that. Then you're back in the discriminatory realm again. You're judging it on and whether it's right or wrong, good or bad. But if you're aware of it in terms of intuitive awareness, you're seeing it through discernment. It is a condition that arises and ceases. And if you're willing to accept it that way, then you can observe its absence. Because that desire to kill Ajahn Sumedho will cease. And then you can discern when it's not present. A few minutes ago I wanted to kill him, now I don't. It's like this. Not wanting to kill is like this, wanting to kill is like this. The discerning ability. And it's not judging, so it's not, you know, not to build guilt and doubt about yourself. When you're using intuitive awareness, and that's where the moral precepts are helpful, because this gives us a clear right to you know to recognize the way things are, which can be immoral, and then we have a choice of not of acting or not acting, you know, so we can follow the immoral inclination or not, but whether we do or not, observe the precept, we refrain from acting on it, but we can certainly discern it in terms of Dhamma. It is what it is. All conditions are impermanent. Well, realize what a great gift this is, because in this society here, and there's so much, and in the Western world, there's so much guilt and self-criticism in the society, because we don't know what to do with what we call our shadow or dark side or the negative side of life. We're afraid of it and we take it personally. We see it as something wrong with, you know, like we see it as some kind of fault or maybe some terrible thing that's wrong with us. People do get very, you know, distressed by having negative thoughts and very guilt-ridden and very, you know, can really, you know, kill themselves or do very violent acts because of it, towards themselves or towards others, because they don't understand it. They haven't discerned it yet. They merely react to it and they identify with it. So if I have an evil thought entering, evil impulse, you know, an unwholesome impulse entering consciousness, I discern it. But if I just react to it, then I think, oh, how can I think such a terrible thing? And then the logic is, I must be a terrible person for having terrible thoughts. And then we start disparaging ourselves, feeling guilty and worrying and suspecting ourselves of all kinds of horrible possibilities. How many of you felt there's something really dark inside you, lurking down deep to jump out at you at any moment? The heart of evil within every human being. Remember, we used to have on the radio in America stories like that. Because we were brought up to believe that human beings are basically sinful. And that their natural inclination is towards evil. That if you didn't have these kind of moral imperatives, we'd all just degenerate. We'd all become kind of promiscuous, sex-obsessed drunkards, telling lies and stealing and beating each other. I mean, it's like if you don't have this kind of moral imperative, you know, threat of being punished for being wicked, then we'd all go the other way. It's this pressure of punishment. Isn't it like you can see it in the, like, capital punishment? In that if in the States, you know, if you, some states still have capital punishment where they're afraid to outlaw it. It is state murder, you know, it's basically immoral, and yet it's done for moral purposes. You know, it's a state murdering somebody. And so this is, but then there's a fear that if they outlawed capital punishment, then there'd be many more murders because our, you know, then you have no control over it. And so, you know, just everybody feel they had a right to murder. But that's not how it works, is it? It's not, you know, if you inform people and education also, so much of modern education is around learning information about other things. But how much learning is spent about what it is to be human, about yourself, about understanding this most obvious reality we're all experiencing, being a conscious human entity that's breathing and feeling and sensing and experiencing pleasure, pain, heat and cold, that has a thinking ability and a retentive memory that remembers everything, especially the extremities. You know, you don't remember what you ate for lunch 40 years ago on this day, 23. So I can't. Impossible. But if something happened, say, if I won the lottery or somebody, lost all my money, then I remember that. So these are extreme events of one's life, you know, the successes and failures. Most of a human lifetime is neither one extreme or the other. It's more the in-between, getting up, putting on your clothes, going to the toilet, eating your meal, and going to work, waiting in the queue, and so, and then, you know, it just goes on like lifetime usually of these not so extreme experiences. And yet the memory seems to always remember it. When I think back to, I have a good memory, so I can remember early childhood, but it was always about some special event. So this is what it is to be a human and conscious on this planet. Like we're all living here on this planet Earth. But then we don't understand what it's like. You know, we identify with the particular place we're English because we're born here. You know, so then we feel, you know, that the French or the Germans or the Chinese or whatever, you know, they're over there. We don't have a sense of a common humanity and a shared experience of suffering that all human beings have. And yet this is what the Buddha was pointing out, that this is the common bond amongst all human beings, is that we're born, we grow up, we get old, we get sick, we die, we lose what we love, we lose our money, inevitably everything at the end. Death is the kind of total loss of everything, including our conscious life within a form. And yet we don't understand that. We don't know what death is, or even is a subject that is not really, very polite to talk about in some circles. But these are the very, very, the nitty-gritty of being human. We're already born, say physically, just talking about physical birth. So this is, you know, the result of being born. Now this is just ordinary common sense, isn't it? This is the result of being born. This body here. If I'd never been born, I wouldn't be sitting here. It's obvious. So that old age is the result of birth. You know, it's not for some personal flaw or something to think is unfair. It's just the way it is. Bodies, you know, they born and they don't stay. We fortunately don't stay infants. We grow up and get old and then die. So these are the obvious realities, but they're reflected upon and observed and recognized. And that ability to reflect on these most obvious reality, on this most obvious reality, is the great gift of our human birth itself. And this is what the Buddha was pointing to. You know, this is the whole essence, the kind of thrust of Buddha Dhamma, or the Buddha's teaching. It was is an encouragement. It's not a doctrinal teaching. It's not about believing it, but in using it for observing your experience of what it is to be conscious, of being sensitive, of feeling life, of this realm that we're in, the sense realm. You know, and getting to know it so well, we're no longer just trying to control it and ignore it or misuse it, but we can understand it, we learn from it, and then we our relationship to the physical world around us, to our own bodies, to the bodies of others, to other humans, to other creatures, to nature itself, is one of respect, understanding, compassion, rather than just greed and controlling it, trying to get it for yourself, trying to keep others from getting it, and the endless wars, strife, and confusion that we generate into our minds and into our society. So at this time, we all see, we all recognize that the world is in a terrible state, the human realm, because there's not much awareness on this level. It's still, you know, power struggling and trying to control, and then fear and jealousy and trying to hold on to mine and reject others and get rid of those that you don't agree with or don't like or don't want. And so this is not wisdom or use of intelligence, but it is. You know, it comes from a certain logic behind it. You can justify anything logically. A genocide you can justify, or anything, you know. If you create a, you know, if you want to just think about it. But if you're getting beyond just the thinking process to pure consciousness, pure awareness, then this is where the discernment, the ability to discern, to intuit, to recognize, and this is where loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity manifest through human individuals into the world. So you can see like the people in the Dalai Lama, for example, kind of represents that, doesn't he? Manifests compassion. You're not supposed to hear that. Very good. You can put on a lower vibration too, so it maybe not be so. I just got it. It bleeps also, if you want. So then my sati sampajanya and my discerning ability is suddenly aware that there is tea on the... And Kunlada has prepared this for us all, and she does this every time. We certainly appreciate her. You don't ever have to ask her, she just does it. And so this is an act of dana, out of goodness and joy of sharing with others. And so this is recognized, you know, this is a kind of foundation for life. If we want a happy life, or a peaceful life, and develop self-respect in that. And dana is the kind of basis for that, generosity. Stinginess does not lead to happiness. Me first, I can feel that way, but it doesn't bring happiness into my life. I don't, you know, I'm not proud of that. Well, I can certainly feel it, but I'm not proud, or do I want to, you know, cultivate me first as a way of living, because if I do, you know, the results of when I've acted on that have been always painful. Because there's always somebody that, you know, is going to hit you or stop you, because they want to go first. So but also, the sila is to live in a way that you respect, that you, you know, respecting the rights and the existence of others, and then to cultivate, or the bhavana, meditation, this awareness, so that your life as a human being has not been a wasted one. You've actually used this opportunity to develop wisdom. And they can to its ultimate completion, then there's non-birth. You don't have to be reborn in the Apasura Deva realm, even. A billion aeons of everyone being the same. Let's say that doesn't sound very good. So I offer this for your reflection and invite you to have a cup of tea, and to then in 15-20 minutes I'll ring the bell and we can have further discussion.